Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Let's take a couple of phone calls, and then we have another guest. Brad in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Brad.
Hi, Brian. Thank you. I guess this is all unfolding in the moment. I want to pick up on what Mr. Schneiderman was saying about the firing of Jolly Yates being a referendum. Specifically, it's a referendum on the nomination of Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. And if I'm not mistaken, that vote is scheduled to happen today, and in fact, in a couple hours. So I guess I want to know what the Senate needs to do. It seems to me like they really need to delay this and reopen questioning of Senator Sessions. What is his position on this executive order? What is his position on standing up in opposition to the president? I don't think they need to rush into this, so I'm wondering if there's agreement with that and what the Senate can do and what they should do.
I think what you ask are the questions that Democrats will want to hear the answers to from Jeff Sessions, and to find out, not that it's probably going to make a difference, but to at least get him on the record standing up for judicial independence or attorney general independence, not in a political sense, as we were discussing before, but when they think something is actually unlawful or unconstitutional that the president wants to do. Now, of course, the attorney general's office was apparently not consulted in advance here. They used the Office of Legal Counsel, which is related but separate. And so, a president generally may not get himself into this situation by looking for guidance from the attorney general first rather than from Rudy Giuliani as to where the law actually – where the line is with respect to the law. Let's listen live for a minute. Let's see what's going on. If it's interesting, we'll stay with it. Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, giving a news conference right now and talking about the immigration, the travel ban.
Our focus first and foremost is on border security. Thank you.
And that was House Speaker.
All right, so we got unlucky there. That started and ended. Those who believe the travel ban is unlawful and unconstitutional point to these sound bites for evidence. Trump on the campaign trail.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
Saying Muslims, obviously. Rudy Giuliani on Fox News Channel on Saturday.
When he first announced it, he said Muslim ban. He called me up. He said, put a commission together. Show me the right way to do it legally. I put a commission together with Judge Mukasey, with Congressman McCall, Pete King, whole group of other very expert lawyers on this. And what we did was we focused on, instead of religion, danger.
And Trump himself on the Christian Broadcasting Network last week.
Do you know, if you were a Christian in Syria, it was impossible, very, very tough to get into the United States. If you were a Muslim, you could come in. But if you were a Christian, it was almost impossible.
Indicating a religious test which raises constitutional questions. But the administration argues it's just common sense to take a 90-day time out to assess the safety of travel from seven countries that Congress and the Obama administration had already identified as of heightened risk of terrorists coming from there. With me on that and more is John Hart, editor-in-chief of the conservative website Opportunity Lives. Previously, Hart served as the longtime communications director for Republican Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma. He also wrote two books with Senator Coburn, Breach of Trust, How Washington Turns Outsiders into Insiders, and The Debt Bomb, A Bold Plan to Stop Washington from Bankrupting America. Hart has an article this week in Opportunity Lives called The Method to Trump's Refugee Madness. John, thank you so much for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you. It's great to be on. I appreciate the invitation.
You wrote that the debate over the travel ban is missing a maybe even bigger story, that this is the first move in a Trump foreign policy toward refugees and the Middle East that will surprise people for how interventionist it is. What kind of intervention are you expecting?
Well, here's what I'm expecting. In 2015, if you remember, really throughout the campaign, Trump talked about what he described as a, quote, big, beautiful safe zone, as only Donald Trump would describe a safe zone, in Syria for refugees. And the whole notion of a safe zone is critical because It really signals a couple of key things that that are significant. Number one, a safe zone commits to the use of force against, by implication, anyone who would make it unsafe. So, and the Russians actually have already reacted to this. The official Russian news outlet RT had an article a few days ago blasting Trump for this, talking about this idea of a safe zone again. I think they hoped he would forget about it. And they essentially implied, you know, don't expect the Russians to stand by idly if he tries to do this. And there's a big debate among humanitarian workers and so forth about international law and safe zones. But there's a long history and precedent for creating these zones to deal with refugee crises. And I think that's a much more aggressive and compassionate response to take towards a refugee situation. And Trump, I think, supports it because, number one, it solves the problem of people coming to this country. There's a security benefit for us in the short term, but there's also a long-term security benefit where you defuse conflict. Rather than creating the next generation of jihadists, you send people home. You show mercy. And that action, again, is very interventionist. And so my the theory of what he's doing is he's setting himself up and his administration to push for safe zones in a way that is more aggressive than people expect him to.
And you know, John,
and I think, frankly, I think the way he's done the ban, I think, is a bit ham-handed. It's you know, wasn't very precise, to say the least. But he's going tough so he can go softer down the road. And he's already put this process in motion, too. He's talked to Arab leaders. He's talked to other governments about doing this safe zone.
There's already a hint of what you say being true, and it's not getting much press. The leaders of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have publicly agreed just in the last couple of days to support a safe zone in Syria and I think also in Yemen. Did you see that, and do you think that means a promise of mostly Saudi boots on the ground, which is something that the U.S. hasn't been able to get them to do?
Well, I do. I do think it's important. Again, it's part of this process. I think you'll see more leaders in the region step up and show a willingness to support a safe zone. And I don't know whose boots on the ground it will be, but it will require, you know, if the president of the United States takes a leadership role, which he's doing, again, there's going to be an implicit threat of force. And that is what scares the Russians and the Iranians, and it should scare them because one of the things Trump has shown is that he means what he says. And so far, when he said something, he's actually gone through with it. And that should worry, that should concern our enemies and potential terrorist groups. That's part of what made us so unsafe under Obama is that he would set a red line in Syria, for example, tell Assad he can't use chemical weapons, and then Assad uses chemical weapons and we do nothing. So that makes us less secure when presidents don't keep their word.
What do you think that'll mean in terms of U.S. troops if they do establish a safe zone as the next step going hand in hand with a refugee ban?
I don't expect we'll have any significant ground troop presence. I think we would have, very limited engagement, just as we do now, in terms of special forces. I think our air force would be the primary method of enforcing that. And again, those are monumental steps. I mean, for a president, people think is going to be a neo-isolationist. The fact that he's moving forward with the safe zone again is going to confuse some of his base. And so I think part of what's happening here, it really is a political move. It's been done carelessly. It's been done recklessly. But I think in their minds, they're thinking, okay, we're about to do something that is going to require multilateral engagement. We're going to look like the Bush administration. They're really not going that far. But they're setting themselves up, I think, with this refugee ban to do something that's going to be more helpful and really more compassionate and in our long-term strategic interests, national interests, et cetera.
Yeah, and I think you raise an important question because a lot of people are confused about how interventionist Trump intends to be. He ran against the Iraq war as something that cost $1 trillion in a foreign country that we could have, you know, spent that money at home on American needs. But he also criticized Obama for not being interventionist enough, as you just did, and promised to destroy ISIS, which could mean a big, beautiful Middle East war, not just a safe zone. Does it hang together for you?
It does hang together. I think what Trump really is in his core is he's a classic pragmatic realist in terms of foreign policy. He will view each foreign policy crisis on a case-by-case basis. And he's not going to have a Trump doctrine like Bush had a doctrine or Reagan had a doctrine, per se. I hope he has, a commitment to freedom, individual liberty, human rights, et cetera. But again, I think he's going to look at each case, each region and situation individually and make an assessment. But he knows that if you make that sort of commitment, you have to follow through, because if you don't follow through, you make everyone less safe. You make our country less safe. You create instability. And that's what I think he's doing. And, Democrats who are attacking his refugee ban, they tweeted out the image of the Syrian boy who drowned, the tragic image of that toddler. And the point I'm making is, look, Obama and Democrats were silent for every step of that boy's journey but his last. And that is intolerable. And I think what Trump is saying is he agrees that that's intolerable. We have to have a smart engagement and an aggressive engagement that keeps is focused on defeating ISIS. And this is part of that plan, I hope.
My guest is John Hart, the editor-in-chief of Opportunity Lives, previously the longtime communications director for Republican Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma. He's written an article on Opportunity Lives called The Method to Trump's Refugee Madness. And let's take some phone calls. Our lines are still full from before, and now some people have called in specifically reacting, John, to some of the things you've been saying. So let's take one of those. Rose in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Rose, thank you so much for calling.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, Brian. I'm a long, long time fan of your show and first time caller.
Thank you so much.
And thank you. And thank you, Mr. Hart, for being on this show and expressing your views. I have a question specifically from your conservative perspective on national security issues. You just now spoke to the instability and making and keeping Trump's promises on making the United States more safe. Do you not see how the immigration ban may be playing directly into the hands of those who wish to radicalize jihadists around the world? I'm wondering if your guest could speak to that, to how this ban is even now is being used on social media as justification by ISIS and other such groups to radicalize and to play right into their viewpoint that America is against Islam and such, outlandish statements as that.
Rose, thank you very much. And this obviously is the security trade-off, right? If we make the country more safe by reducing the risk of people being sent in by ISIS as fake refugees, do we increase the risk more as, say, John McCain and Lindsey Graham? That's becoming one word, by the way, John McCain and Lindsey Graham, as they both have maintained, that it increases the risk more than it reduces the risk for the reasons that Rose was saying. What's your own view on that, if you have one?
No, I do. That's a terrific question. I think, and just a quick aside is, I've spent time working overseas. I was in the Balkans after the Kosovo crisis, and I've traveled throughout the Middle East. So I've seen how people perceive what we say within the United States and the effect it has. And so I'm very sensitive to pronouncements like the one we heard a few days ago. So I find fault with both the Trump administration and his critics in how they perceive what this is. Number one, it could have been done much more carefully in a targeted way. If the goal really is to mitigate security risks, you want to include other countries like Egypt or Pakistan, where we know that they've shown that they train jihadists. So there's a high risk from those countries, but they were excluded in the ban. So let's conclude that that's something they perhaps should have done if they were really focused on making a security argument as opposed to a political one. Number two is the critics have said are the ones really describing this as a Muslim ban. So Trump has strongly pushed back against that. Some of the most populous countries on earth in terms of Muslim population are not included you know, like Indonesia, Egypt, and five or six others.
Right. Although on that point,
that supports the argument that this is not a comprehensive Muslim ban per se.
Yeah, but the critics would say, well, you got to start somewhere, and if they're going to try to get away with it as somehow palatable, then that sequence of clips that we played a minute ago that you heard with Trump saying on the campaign trail he's going to do a Muslim ban, and then Giuliani saying Trump came to him and say, well, how do I do a Muslim ban legally, that we see what it is.
No, and I think that's a fair point. I think as conservatives who are committed to human rights, we should be on guard, absolutely. And if he tries to extend this, I think you'd see opposition not just from the Lindsey Graham wing, but from many more conservatives than you are now. Ben Sasse, senator from Nebraska, he has a good statement that really echoes the sentiment that the caller expressed, that we have to be very careful with how we pursue legitimate security interests, because we don't want to end up polarizing and creating new enemies as we try to protect ourselves from existing enemies.
Let's take another call. Neil in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC. Neil, thanks for calling.
Yes, can you hear me?
I can.
Thank you, Brian. I was struck by what your guest said about thinking that Trump is a pragmatic realist. I'd like to suggest the exact opposite of that this, he mentioned that the ban could have been structured more judiciously. But from what I understand, the inner circle of Bannon and Miller and other people were informed by DHL, Department of Homeland Security lawyers, that was exactly what they wanted, and they were overruled. And that what Bannon is trying to do is precisely not be judicious, but to make a statement that we are going to be a radical nationalist administration that doesn't answer to the standard bureaucracy. And that I think that that's what the language of the inaugural speech was saying, that we take back the government from the government. And David Brook echoed that in his column this morning.
David
Brook. This is a radical nationalist government, and that the point of this ban is to, in fact, break all the connections with, or to be an opening shot in doing that. So I'd like to hear what your conservative guests would have to say about that.
John, go ahead.
Yes. No, I think that's a worry that I expressed quite frequently during the campaign. I was, you know, my personal transition has been from being never Trump. I was actively opposing him, trying to get other people to run, including my former boss. And I'm at a point now where I'm being, quote, willfully optimistic. And I hope history won't show that I've been naively optimistic. But, you know, he is the president. I don't see that he was swept into office in a nationalist movement. And when I hear him talk about reducing the size and power of government, I think that is a mainstream conservative idea, that we want to shift power out of Washington. Washington's been ineffective. So that is not alarming to me. In fact, it's encouraging that he wants to do that and to create a check on the bureaucratic state. I think that's a very good thing. But I think what you have to look at all of the fact pattern in total. If he goes forward with what I think he's already suggested and has put in motion, is this safe zone, that is something that does not fit into the conclusion that the caller expressed, that, or that David Brooks has said, is that we're going to have a radical nationalistic presidency, because that is not a nationalistic policy. It's when you engage in multilateral agreements, you engage other leaders in the region, you conduct very complex foreign policy. That is not a radical isolationist type of posture. So that remains to be seen. He hasn't fully implemented that or gone through with it. But he sent all the signals that he's going to. And I really think in my gut, this was a somewhat amateurish political move that they did. They wanted to show their base they were being tough on the refugee question so they can have the freedom and flexibility to do something that's going to be confusing to their base, which is put the safe zone in place.
To follow up on the caller's question, Yeah, if it's a policy aimed at a safe zone as an alternative way of dealing with refugees and enforced by a coalition of governments, United States and maybe other European and countries in the region, in the Middle East, that's a policy that sounds like it's, whether it works or not, it's a pragmatic effort to deal with the refugees in a different way than today. To the larger question of where Steve Bannon and Trump are trying to take the government, how much are you a Steve Bannon fan versus how concerned are you that he's accumulating too much power in the White House and that his vision is, in a larger sense, more nationalist or even white nationalist, not white nationalist in the old, you know, blacks and Jews KKK sense,
sure.
But Western culture, Christian Western culture needs to be defended against so many Muslims coming in, white American culture, European culture in this country needs to be defended from too many Latin Americans coming in,
right.
And, you know, and religious overlays to that.
Right. Let me address it by saying that the two people that have been connected to this band, Stephen Miller and Steve Bannon, I don't know Steve personally. I know Stephen, not intimately well, but we weren't best friends, but we've worked in the Senate together and attended lots of meetings with them. He is not a menacing character. So to me, it's a little bit laughable that people are demonizing Stephen Miller. Steve Bannon, again, I don't know him. Some of what he said and what he did with Breitbart is concerning. Some of it I like and applaud. I think his instincts to go after big government generally, crony capitalism, wasteful spending, you know, go down the list. There's a lot of things I agree with Steve Bannon on. But his nationalistic rhetoric definitely is concerning because I think it ultimately weakens the United States. If you want to make America first, you have to have, you know, what I call enlightened self-interest, which recognizes how we fit in the world. Some of his arguments against globalism, I think, are silly. Globalism is not a political philosophy. There's no movement. Globalism is a consequence of technological change and innovation that has largely been driven by American power and, you know, economic power, intellectual power. We've created an economically interdependent world, and that is one of the greatest security achievements in the past 60 years. You know, we haven't had a great power war, not just because of the notion of mutually assured destruction through nuclear weapons, but because of the assumption of mutually assured growth. In other words, it's in no one's interest for the U.S. and China to have a major war. And that is a remarkable achievement. Again, that's no one's going to run on that. It's not a bumper sticker, economic interdependence, you know, make us safe. But that's how the world actually works. And I think Steve Bannon should know that. And so I think a lot of his rhetoric, I think, is silly, honestly, on that front.
My guest is John Hart, if you're just joining us. He was a longtime communications director for Republican Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma. He is now editor-in-chief of the website Opportunity Lives. For people who haven't seen Opportunity Lives, and this is your first time on this show, so people haven't heard you before who maybe just listen here, do you want to introduce Opportunity Lives and say
sure.
What it is?
You bet. Yeah, Opportunity Lives, where it's a conservative news site launched a couple years ago. And what makes us unique is in a environment where most outlets have what I call a conflict bias. In other words, they follow the process, they follow the fight. We have a solutions bias. So our approach is to focus on what works. You know, an example is this article I just did is what actually is the best way to get at this refugee question. So we're trying to bring more light than heat and, you know, raise the level of debate a little bit. You know, in my background is I work for Coburn. For over a decade, and he was known as Dr. No, and we had a very effective run at blocking bad bills and have no regrets about that. In fact, he wishes we would have done more to block bad things, and so do I. But at the same time, he was a propositional conservative, not just an oppositional one. He led the way in terms of offering alternatives to Obamacare, how to reform Social Security disability, fix entitlements, and the media doesn't really focus on the solution side of it. So we wanted to create a platform with that mission in mind of talking about solutions and what works from a center-right perspective.
And not every listener is going to agree with all your positions, but I appreciate your thoughtful approach. And I want you to give me 3 minutes. I'm going to play a few clips here on the Sally Yates incident, and then I want to get your take, okay?
Okay.
We got so much reaction at the beginning of the show when we played two clips from Sally Yates' confirmation hearing to be Deputy Attorney General in 2015 that I'm going to replay them now. It's been almost an hour, so we have mostly new audience. Sally Yates, when she was confirmed to be Deputy Attorney General, and of course Sally Yates is the acting AG who said last night that she finds the travel ban unlawful, so as Attorney General of the United States, she could not enforce it, and then President Trump fired her. This is Sally Yates at her confirmation hearing to be Deputy Attorney General in 2015, being questioned in the Senate Judiciary Committee by none other than Jeff Sessions.
If the views the president wants to execute are unlawful, should the attorney general or the deputy attorney general say no?
Senator, I believe that the attorney general or the deputy attorney general has an obligation to follow the law and the Constitution and to give their independent legal advice to the president.
I remember John Ashcroft is attorney general for Bush, and he's been celebrated for being in, when he was in the hospital, they tried to get him to sign a document that dealt with terrorism that he thought went too far. He refused to do so. So I hope that you feel free to say no in the character of John Ashcroft and others who said no to President Nixon on certain issues.
So that, as you might guess, has led Democrats to start formulating some new questions for Jeff Sessions, who hasn't been confirmed yet as Attorney General, which is why Sally Yates was there in the first place as acting Attorney General. Loretta Lynch left on Inauguration Day. And so they've been talking on the Senate floor about this. And here's about a minute and a half of Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California just a few minutes ago.
Yesterday, early in the evening, we clearly saw what a truly independent attorney general does. Sally Yates, the acting attorney general, who enjoyed broad bipartisan support when she was confirmed as deputy attorney general, declared that under her leadership, the department could not defend Trump's executive order on immigrants and refugees. Here's what she wrote, and it's important, and I quote, "My responsibility is to ensure that the position of the Department of Justice is not only legally defensible, but is informed by our best view of what the law is after consideration of all the facts. In addition, I am responsible for ensuring that the positions we take in court remain consistent with this institution's solemn obligation to always seek justice and stand for what is right. At present, I am not convinced that the defense of the executive order is consistent with these responsibilities, nor am I convinced that the executive order is lawful," end quote. Consequently, for as long as I am the Attorney General, the Department of Justice will not present arguments in defense of the executive order until I become convinced that it is appropriate to do so. Members, that statement took guts. That statement said what an independent attorney general should do. That statement took a steel spine to stand up and say no.
Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California, just a few minutes ago. Our guest, John Hart, editor-in-chief of Opportunity Lives. Just curious to get your take on the whole Sally Yates incident.
A couple of things. I think I don't see that as particularly courageous. I think it was grandstanding. I think it was opportunistic. I think she saw a moment to rush the stage of American politics and grab the mic and offer a speech. What I think the appropriate action would have been in this case is for her to go to the president privately and say, I don't believe this is lawful. I'm not comfortable supporting this. And if the president says no, you have to, then she could resign. And I think her resignation actually would have made Dianne Feinstein's argument more powerful, because what she did in the last sentence of her statement, she said she will not present arguments in defense of the executive order, comma, unless and until I become convinced that it is appropriate to do so. And what she did in that statement, when she says, until I become convinced, she put herself above the Supreme Court, above the presidency, and above all the institutions, and said, it's all about me. It's all about my optics and what I think is right. And she put herself ahead of the institutions of government. And she would have made a stronger case by simply going to the president privately, and let's assume that he would say, no, you need to do this, and then she would resign. And that would make a more powerful argument in favor of the rule of law, in favor of her institutions. But instead, you know, she could have been a martyr, but instead she's going to be viewed as a gadfly, quite frankly.
Do you think it puts Jeff Sessions or the Republicans in the Senate in a different political position than they were in 24 hours ago, barely 12 hours ago? This unfolded all so suddenly. Because of the way he questioned her in 2015 and kind of course, the context there, you know, the politics are always different when the shoe is on your foot, right? Mm-hmm. So in that case, she was being confirmed as deputy attorney general when Obama was president. And so Jeff Sessions was interested in her getting on the record saying she would be independent if she thought something was unlawful. Well, then Trump became president, and lo and behold, she's the acting attorney general, and she follows through with that, maybe in the best way, maybe you're suggesting not in the best way. Does it put the Republicans in the Senate in any different kind of position with respect to Jeff Sessions? Does it put his confirmation any further in doubt as a matter of politics?
No, it does not put it in doubt. And again, I think what Sessions would, if he was asked, would say is something to the effect that I described, is that, you know, the only response in this situation is to resign. It's not to grandstand and use your position to make a political statement. So no, I don't see it as a great conflict or difficulty that they face.
John Hart, editor-in-chief of Opportunity Lives, former communications director for Senator Tom Coburn. Thank you so much for coming on with us today.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Hope it won't be the last time. Thank you very much.